Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. WandasPicks.asmnetwork.org. Tune in Wednesdays 6 to 7 a.m. and Fridays 8 to 10 a.m. Pacific Time. This is a Black arts and culture site. We will be exploring the African diaspora via the writing, performance, both musical and theatrical, film and stage, as well as the visual arts of Africans in the diaspora and those influenced by these aesthetic forms of expression. I'm interested in the political and social ramifications of art on society, specifically movements supported by these artists and their forebears. It is my claim that the artists are the true revolutionaries, their work honest and filled with raw, unedited passion. They are true heroes. Ashe. So remember, visit us on Wednesdays 6 to 7 a.m. and Fridays 8 to 10 a.m. Pacific Time on wandaspicks.asmnnetwork.org. Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, the day after that day that the pilgrims showed their thanks to the indigenous people that saved their lives by massacring them. Yeah, the real Thanksgiving. There's a website, danielpaul.com, The Real Thanksgiving, where he talks about this holiday proclaimed in 1863 by Abraham Lincoln as a fairy tale, a feast that was allowed to exist in the American imagination pretty much untouched until 1970, the 350th anniversary of the landing of the pilgrims. That's when Daniel Paul says, Frank B. James, president of the Federated Eastern Indian League, prepared a speech for Plymouth banquet that exposed the pilgrims for having committed, among other crimes, the robbery of the graves of the Wampanoags. He wrote, "We welcome you, the white man, with open arms, little knowing that it was the beginning of the end, that before 50 years were to pass, the Wampanoag would no longer be a free people." End quote. But white Massachusetts officials told him he could not deliver such a speech and offered to write on him another. Instead, James declined to speak, and on Thanksgiving Day, hundreds of indigenous people, Native Americans, from around the country came to protest. It was the first National Day of Mourning, a day to mark the losses of Native Americans suffered as the early settlers prospered. This true story of Thanksgiving is what whites did not want Mr. James to tell. And then he goes on to talk about what really happened in Plymouth in 1621. I suggest that you visit that website, perhaps before or after you go out and shop. It's interesting that for once the term black, as in Black Friday, carries a positive connotation. However, only a positive connotation if you're one of the many corporate entities that are trying to make money to salvage one's, you know, maybe the bottom line that might not be going so well prior to the day after Thanksgiving, which is the day that most people go out and shop. It's one of the biggest days for generating income in the calendar year. It would have been a great day for those that are supporting the occupation of this United States to declare, you know, don't shop on Black Friday. So anyway, just a few things for you to think about. And last week we had on the air two members of Umoja, wonderful band, Damu Sudi Ali and Muhammad Bilal Hanif, and they were talking about the CD release party of Umoja, Dance of the Kalahari, in memoriam of Kamal Saitu and Kenneth Bird, two members of Umoja that we lost all too soon. However, they were a part of the band when this particular second CD was recorded, and so the CD release party was so wonderful last week, last Sunday, November 20th at the 57th Street Gallery. And we thought we were going to have on the air another wonderful musician, Melvin Butts, but he's not going to be joining us. But he has a gig on Sunday, same place, 57th Street Gallery, Sunday, November 27th. And then coming up in December, early December, I believe December 2nd, maybe not exactly, but you should check it. The jazz professor Bill Bell is going to be performing, and another one of our former guests, I'm drawing a blank. Ooh, this is so horrible. Oh, Barbara Hunter, sorry. Barbara Hunter is going to be having another concert, and as we were leaving on Sunday, the 20th, there was another concert. There was like two concerts in one day, like an afternoon concert and an evening concert. And if I hadn't had to go to work the next day, I certainly would have stayed. So anyway, 57th Street Gallery, independent venue that's really throwing down some great, great performance of live music. There's a Blue Mondays where people can come and sing and jam. Sounds really fun. Melvin Butts is one of the hosts of that. And Kahil Shahid, when he fills up to it, he's also there. Definitely want to send some prayers out to him. As you know, he's been sick with a terminal illness. So, yeah, there's a whole lot of things for us to be thankful for, even if the holiday is not necessarily one we want to remember in that way. So I am going to play a song from Dance of the Kalahari, In Memoriam, that I really love, and it was composed by Kenneth Bird, and that's him you're going to be hearing on the flute. It's called Yesterday's Lettuce, because a lot of people eat a lot of leftovers after feasting and stuffing themselves on what is known as Thanksgiving Day. And I don't know how many folks were at the went to the sunrise ceremony at Alcatraz, a land reclaimed by the indigenous people, American Indian Movement, many years ago, and that's a wonderful event. I didn't go this year, but I'm sure, you know, the folks were holding it down, sort of sending up smoke signals to the ancestors and, just sort of looking at how things have come full circle, you know, occupying Alcatraz, a former prison, and then occupying this country, you know, folks taking it back. Taking back a land that was stolen so many years ago from the indigenous folks. Okay, so here we go. Yesterday's Lettuce, and then we're going to scoot right into an excerpt of a interview I had, I guess at the beginning of the season for San Jose, Opera San Jose, and Jovanka Jean-Baptiste, a soprano, is going to be talking about her first, because you're not going to be able to hear it all, her first opera that she's in, and you'll be able to catch her. Jovanka is Haitian, and I think she grew up in New York, I think she grew up in Newark. I'm not sure exactly. We've had her on before. I don't remember the details, but I know she's Haitian born, and she performs this Sunday at 3 p.m. at the matinee, if you want to catch her. And she's going to talk a little bit about this opening, her opening role this season. She's performing as Netta, and I don't know how to pronounce this. Shoot. She does it for me so well, and I'm not certain how to do it, so I'm not going to even try. And then she's going to be performing in La Traviata as Violetta and Marguerite in Faust. So, anyway, she's one of the resident artists in Opera San Jose, and it's a really wonderful conversation. So we're going to just scoop right on into that. And then after that, Larry Douglas from Umoja is going to join us to talk about Dance of the Kalahari, and we're going to listen to some more music from this great, great sophomore CD out of the ensemble. And then L. Peter Callender is going to join us from African American Shakespeare Company to talk about their season and the opening of Cinderella, their holiday treat that people just love to see, and that's going to be opening on December 2nd. And then we're going to close with a wonderful conversation with well-known and celebrated peacemaker and author Luis Rodriguez. He's got a sort of a sequel to his Always Running, and it's called It Calls You Back, An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, Revolutions, and Healing. So we're really looking forward to that. All righty, so here we go. Yesterday's Lettuce. second year as a member of the as a resident member artist of Opera San Jose, and you're opening with a bang.
More like a stab.
Yeah, and I'm like, what is it with you and these women, these characters?
You know what? As I've always said, all of my roles, the majority of my roles, except in Mozart, I have some sort of death, whether it's suicide, stabbing, poisoning, something. I die. Sometimes it's terminal illness, you know. It's never the same death, but there's always death. Now, I don't die in any of Mozart's operas, and I don't die in Falstaff. Well, actually, it's just three Verdi operas I don't die in, but most of the time, it's death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. It's like, and we're so sad when your characters pass away.
Yeah, but it makes you a good opera, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. So, this one here sounds really interesting because the audience is going to actually have two operas in one evening or one afternoon. That sounds pretty cool.
Yes, we're doing a double bill. The first opera of the evening will be La Voix Humaine, which is the human voice,
mm-hmm.
and it's an opera by Poulenc. And Poulenc, he wrote two operas that people know very well, the one being La Voix and the other being Dialogue of the Carmelites, which is actually done more than than La Voix.
Mm-hmm.
But La Voix is really interesting because it's a one-act opera, and it's only one person on stage the entire time. There's no chorus.
Oh.
There are no secondary characters.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the one female singer on the telephone going through, you know, what every person, male or female, has gone through at one point in their life, a really bad breakup.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be an interesting thing to pair with the Pagliacci, which I'm in,
mm-hmm.
Which is, again, it's some sort of breakup, but not the typical breakup, obviously. It's essentially, pairing those two describes how a man and a woman take breakups. Sometimes it reverses. Sometimes the woman is more violent and vengeful than the man is.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just showing these two sides to the end of a relationship, with the woman being on the phone trying to convince both her former lover, who is getting married the next day, by the way, that she's fine, and convincing herself that she's fine, but really she's not, and she can't keep that from him. And also then in Pagliacci, where it's the wife, Netta, who I play,
mm-hmm.
she's been unfaithful, but not the typical, I'm just going to go out and have another lover because I don't care about my husband. It's way more complex than that. You know, she's not truly happy in her life as a traveling performer. She's a great actress, and she can put on the face to convince people and, you know, convince her husband and the rest of the troupe that she loves what she does, and to some extent she does. And her marriage with Canio, again, complex. It's not the typical fairy tale romance. You know, there is, he is older than her. I won't say he's 4 years older than her. He's not. But he is older than her, and that, I think, that plays a role in it also. The fact that, you know, she is essentially an orphan. She's an orphan, and he took her from the orphanage and gave her a life. And I know that she feels some sort of gratitude and respect for that, but she wants more than the life that she's had for, you know, however many years she's had been on the road.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting how Canio, her husband, deals with the breakup. You know, it results in her death and the death of her lover, and it's just not as simple as, oh, he gets mad and he kills, you know, the two people that made him mad. It's much more than that, and I like that we're pairing these two operas together, because in La Voix, it's sort of implied, but not really,
mm-hmm.
that the character at the end, who's only known by elle, which is French for she, it's implied that she may or may not commit suicide after the phone call is over. We don't really know, and Poulenc never made it clear, and I think that's a brilliant way to do it. So there is a hint of death, and death may not necessarily be a bad thing. There's death in relationships. It's the death of something. It's the death of a life that you had, and now there has to be the next step, the moving on. So I think the audience would be really excited to see these two operas together. Usually it's Cavalleria Rusticana and Pagliacci that are put together.
Mm-hmm.
So to do these, I think at first, you know, people were scratching their heads, thinking, what do these two have in common? But they do. I mean, Pagliacci is Verismo, which is an opera genre that is based more in the realism of life, in emotions. It's not necessarily fairy tale or have supernatural elements to it, but rather it's something that, you know, you can sit in a theater and go, yep, I've been through that. Yes, I've seen that. Oh, I said that once. And really connect to it. I think maybe even more sometimes than other operas.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and there are some famous songs in both of these operas that people know. I was reading about it, and I was trying to think. One is actually one of the famous songs is known by its English translation. I'm trying to remember which one that is. Where are my notes?
I think you're talking about the tenor's aria.
What's it called?
Well, the tenor's aria, which is the most famous from the whole show.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Vesti la giubba, which is put on the costume. Mm-hmm. He sings it after he's discovered Netta with her lover, with the help of Tonio, who is sort of the Iago of the opera. He really is. And, I mean, actually, the voice type that normally sings Tonio is the voice type, the baritone, as we call it, that sings Iago in Otello and Count di Luna in Trovatore and so on and so on. They sing those really meaty baritone roles. And I would say Iago and Tonio are similar, not the same, but similar, because Iago's motives are purely based out of the fact that he just doesn't like Otello. He just despises the fact that this dark-skinned man has everything that he wants and uses, you know, other characters to help bring him down, whereas Tonio at first doesn't entertain really designs to bring Canio down until he's rejected by Netta, who he's in love with.
Mm-hmm.
She spurns him, he attacks her, and, you know, she fights back, and he decides then and there, well, if I can't have her, I'm going to make sure her husband knows, you know, what she's doing, because he comes back later on in the play and catches her with her lover, Silvio, and that's how Tonio, you know, discovers that, tells Canio. It's a chain reaction. So but that's the aria, the Vesti la giubba,
mm-hmm.
what Canio sings after he's discovered, you know, Netta with her lover, and he's chased Silvio off, but hasn't caught him. Then he threatens Netta to kill her, but wants to know the name of her lover first, and luckily, it's all stopped by Beppe, who's played by Michael Daly. I know you've talked with Michael before.
Oh, for real?
Wonderful Michael Daly is doing our Beppe.
Oh.
And after everyone has left, Canio is just sitting here saying, I have to put on this costume. I have to play the clown. I have to make the audience laugh. I have to act as if everything is wonderful,
mm-hmm.
but inside, I'm hurting. My heart is breaking. I've been betrayed.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the most famous. I mean, if I hum a few bars right now, your listeners are going to go, I've heard that.
Oh, okay. Hum a few bars. Go ahead.
I knew you were going to ask me. It's Vesti la giubba nella faccia follia. Everybody knows that opening line. It's so well known.
I know that. I didn't know that's
exactly.
What that was about.
And there are four arias in the show, and that really is the most well-known.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most well-known, and it's as it should be. I mean, the opera really is centered on Canio and what he does. I would say Lavoie doesn't really have an aria, because Lavoie, again, is one person.
Mm-hmm.
So the music is not going to be as familiar unless somebody is really someone who is an operaphile, as I like to call them. They really know the genre, and I've heard a lot of Poulenc before,
mm-hmm.
but I have every faith that they will love what they hear of the Lavoie, and of course they'll love the Pagliacci, because they'll see elements of the show and of the libretto, the words, in their own lives. You know, everybody's been through a breakup. Everybody has, you know, fallen in love head over heels, almost to the point of crazy. Some of us have even been betrayed with infidelity. Some of us have been spurned and rejected after pouring our heart out to someone that we love. Everybody has gone through this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it makes for a really intense operatic experience, especially for somebody who may have never have seen an opera before. Maybe this double bill will be their first opera, and they go and they have this incredibly intense experience, and they fall in love with the genre, which is what we hope. That's what we want.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking, Pagliacci, is that how you pronounce it?
Pagliacci.
Yes. Players or Clowns. It's really interesting that it's actually a play within a play. It's a story within a story, and then, you know, around the climax, the two merge, and one can't tell one from the other. That's really
right.
Interesting.
I love the idea of the play within a play. So it's in the second act. The opera's two acts, but it's really a short two-act opera,
mm-hmm.
About 70 minutes long. And so the play is the second act where, you know, that's the reason why they've come to the town in the first place, in the beginning of the show, is they come to this town. Every year they do the circuit, you know, the Pagliacci tour circuit, and they always come to this town, and the villagers know the show, they know the players, they've seen the show 1,000 times, but they love it. You know, it's like when you have a favorite movie. One of my favorite movies is Coming to America. It comes on, I have to watch it. I know all the lines, but I have to watch that show. I have to watch the movie because I love it. So it's the same thing. And so in the play, you know, they start out the play as they always do. The characters do their thing. Neta is Colombina, who's a very quick-witted, sort of saucy, soubrette-ish kind of character. She's, you know, very cute, but she's clever, and she, you know, she always kind of saves the day. And Tonio becomes Taddeo, who's sort of kind of like the buffoon. And Beppe becomes Alecchino, the dashing lover. And Canio becomes Pagliaccio, who is the husband of Colombina, who, you know, in the play, when it's done the way they usually do the play, if this was, you know, real life, at the end, Pagliacci discovers Alecchino is the lover of Colombina, and, you know, Pagliacci just gives in and says, oh, all is forgiven, and sometimes even lets himself get a little beating with a cane, but it always ends happily. It's never badly. But because of what has just happened in the previous act, when, first of all, Tonio starts to sort of slip in back into the real world, things that he says to Neda as Colombina becomes, it starts to blur the line between the play they always do and the reality of what they've just gone through. And then once Canio comes on as Pagliaccio, it changes. He hears Neda as Colombina say the same exact words that she says to her lover in real life before he discovered them. Literally the same words.
Mm-hmm.
Hasta noche e per sempre io sarò tua. After tonight, forever and always, I am all yours. The same words, and it clicks something on for him, and he's just barely holding on as the character Pagliaccio, when really, as Canio, he's feeling this incredible rage and vengefulness. And by the time he makes it onto the stage within a stage, he loses it completely. So when the character Tonio talks at the beginning of the opera, before we go into Act One, the prologue, when he talks about how the author, in this case, Leon Cavallo, who wrote the opera, is trying to show you that this is not just fake. This is real life. These characters are feeling real feelings. It's a brilliant way to show that sometimes the fake is the reality, and the reality is fake. You know, that Neta, who's been playing this, the ever-dutiful wife, you know, really wants to be someone else. She's been playing a character within a character within a character. In fact, I think they all are.
Mm-hmm.
They're all sort of putting on a show, even in their real life. And only when, for example, when Neda is alone and she sings her aria, the bird song, Storido no lassù, only when she's alone can she truly turn it off, completely turn off being the you know, life of the show and, you know, the actress that can make everybody laugh and smile and applaud for her and just be herself and be alone with her thoughts. So I really love how this opera can play on that. And it's a brilliant thing that's been done. And our director, Cynthia Stokes, she's really sort of tapped into the whole thing about the complexity of that, of how there are so many layers to these characters. It's not just one or two layers. There are so many. Mm-hmm. And even at the end of the opera, we haven't quite seen them all. Mm. We haven't quite seen all of the layers. And I think that's what's going to make this production really, really great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking as you were talking about your character and others in the in this opera, about Josephine Baker's character in the film Zuzu, also the name of the character. Do you know Zuzu?
I know Josephine Baker, but I don't think I've ever seen the movie, but that's something I'm going to look up.
Yeah, well, this particular one was released in 1934. It's a French film, and I'm not certain how to pronounce Mark's last name, but Allegret, maybe.
Allegret, yeah.
Yeah, and so Zuzu is raised with her brother John, and she's like adopted by by Jean's father, and they grow up as, you know, children, but she actually falls in love with him.
Mm-hmm.
And but he doesn't see her as a girlfriend. He sees her as, you know. Well, you're not going to be able to hear the end of my recap of the story of Zuzu because Larry Douglas is in the studio. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. How are you, Wanda?
Oh, I'm doing good. I'm doing good. That was Jovanka Jean-Baptiste. She's one of the company members of Opera San Jose, and she's rebroadcasting an interview with her that I recorded, broadcast on November 9th. So people can go and look in the archives on November 9th to see how that story ends. Because the interview was actually an hour long, and we only played about 14 minutes of it. I was wondering, do you want to start with a song, or do you want me to start with your bio? I already told our audience a little bit about you at the top of the hour, and I played, what's it called, Day Old at Letters, or Yesterday's Letters.
Oh, yeah. Just Yesterday's Letters.
Yeah.
Like that one. Kenneth Barrett wrote that one.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
One of the personnel of the group who the CD is in memoriam to and for his contribution.
Right, yeah.
Yesterday's Letters.
Yeah, I love that piece. So, yeah, do you want me to play a little bit? Want me to play something of yours? Or what? Maybe we should start maybe with your bio, and then
let's start with my bio. That's fine.
Okay, alrighty. Well, this is actually published in AllMusic, so people can go read it. Craig Harris wrote it, and it says with a tone that the dean of American jazz critics, Leonard Feather, described as, quote, velvety and silky, end quote. Larry Douglas has ruled as one of San Francisco's top trumpet flugelhorn players for more than three decades. In addition to leading his own electroacoustic group, the Larry Douglas Altet, Douglas has worked with such stellar musicians as Freddie Hubbard, Chuck Berry, Albert Collins, Sun Ra, and Rufus and Carla Thomas. As a member of Johnny Otis and his orchestra, his playing was featured on four albums, including the Grammy-nominated Spirit of the Black Territory Band. His debut solo album, Dedications, released in 1985, received a great response from fans in Europe and the Eastern Bloc. Douglas has collaborated with flute saxophone player and director of the jazz program at the University of California, Santa Cruz, Dr. Carlton Hester, since the late 1970s, playing with Hester's groups, the Contemporary Jazz Art Movement and the Hesterian Musicism.
Musicism.
Yeah, musicism. Nice word. The recipient of a bachelor. Huh?
I said that's Carlton for you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was just thinking about the brother who wrote the liner notes. Yeah, he also creates words.
Oh,
Yeah, the liner, the one who wrote the liner notes for Dance of the Kalahari. Tell us his name.
Oh yeah, Lance Williams, I think it is.
Yeah, Lance Williams. Yeah, he coined some new words when he was talking about your music. I mean, the existing lexicon didn't do you all justice, so he had to make up some words to talk about this album, which is, you know, really, really fantastic. Larry Douglas is the recipient of a bachelor's degree in instrumental music education from Florida A&E. A&M, a black
A&M.
University.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a black university, right? One of the historic ones?
It sure is, one of the historical.
Yeah, and a master's of music degree from the San Francisco Conservatory. He has shared his knowledge with students at Aptos Middle School from 1981 to 1990 and Galileo High School of San Francisco since 1991. He also teaches black music, jazz, blues, and popular music in American culture, a jazz history course at Vista Community College. Oh, are you teaching it now at Berkeley?
No.
Oh.
I haven't since, I think, 05, 06.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Well, Vista, for those who don't know that name,
it's
now called
Berkeley
Community College. Yeah.
It was a quite celebrated class. I mean, we would have attendance. Well, Johnny Otis was the actual featured lecturer, but I was the instructor of record.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I had to do all of the dirty work. Well, he received all the glamour, but that's not here and there. We had some really bang up times
mm-hmm.
in that class at Ashkenaz.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I heard of it. It was definitely a living history course because he would bring in
it
people.
It sure was. You got that right. A living history.
Yeah. And you are who's who among American teachers honors our nation's most respected teachers and has placed Larry T. Douglas on his roster for the past 3 years. Wow, editions 7 through 9, 2002,
yeah.
2005. Wow, that's heck of cool. How do you do that?
Well, you know, it's funny, Wanda. Galileo is predominantly an Asian popular school.
Mm-hmm.
And out of all of the students that I've had at Galileo, several Asian students bought in to my philosophy as a teacher and found that it was also life experience and something that they could carry and thought about me. Well, anyway, students have to recommend you.
Oh.
And the students, after they have left
mm-hmm.
Their respective high schools and have at least made the dean's list.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
So that's the honor. That's one of the criterias for the who's who.
Yeah. And, you know, some of your students were in the audience at the concert last Sunday. and one of them is actually he's a teacher now.
He's actually a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
When they first contacted me about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I had been going through my mind on who they are, trying to place them. I got the proper year with the faces and just the structure because I had them in middle school. That's 6th, 7th, and 8th grade.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're 30-plus years old.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
They're full-grown. So it's But the amazing thing was the expression. They still had that youthful expression
mm-hmm.
that I saw when they came in Aptos. In the 80s,
right,
and they have that glow now,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting and wonderful.
Yeah, because Ray, you know, he teaches, you know, history now, and then David was there. He was they were 1989 to 90, and then Nicole was there. She took flute and alto sax. It's like, oh, this is so cool. Yeah, like four of them brought along. One of them brought along his girlfriend. It was so nice. She told me about them, and that's why I was like, oh, I got to get a picture. I didn't get a chance to email them about this, so I have to email them, you know, and let them know about the show so they can listen to it in the archives.
That was a great time in my life. Matter of fact, Illusions.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And Untitled was written in a jazz class that I had in Aptus.
Oh, wow.
So Untitled is very special.
Mm-hmm.
And in the actual release, I had three of the young gentlemen to perform with me. Now, these guys are 40 years plus now. But anyway.
Wow. You mean they're on the actual.
I told you about that release.
Yeah.
You know, I will release it on the CD,
mm-hmm.
Re-release it. Maybe in the next month or so.
Hmm.
So there'll be some rhyme to reason about me.
Wow, that is so neat. Yeah, maybe we should play it. You want to play Illusions?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay,
that
sure.
Yeah.
Okay, and then we'll come back and talk about, you know, you being a Southerner. and about that all that cooking you did yesterday and that fried turkey.
Oh yeah.
So let's play Illusions.
Thank you.
remember that one from last week. Yeah, you were, like I was telling you on the phone yesterday, you were just such a magnificent conductor, you know.
Thank you. At the
CD party. That was such a fun afternoon. It had been raining, storming, like literally. And then, you know, we had this moment where people can get there to the venue and enjoy themselves and get home before perhaps it starts storming again. It was a really, really wonderful afternoon. And you
it
all
sure
were
was.
Really fantastic.
Sure
mm-hmm.
I really wish more people could have came out, but I understand. I understand with the inclement weather, you know, it can be quite difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But let me tell you, the mighty few that were there, they were treated to some sensational musicians on piano, Damo Sudi Ali, on alto and soprano saxophone, M.B. Hanif, on drums, Greg German, on bass, Alex Smith, and guest star Molly Vinson Williams, also on bass. That was a party. It really was.
Yes, certainly was a party. Yeah. So you are a native of Statesboro, Georgia. I've never heard of Statesboro.
Statesboro, Georgia.
Yeah.
That's
and
right.
You write about you had like an older brother, Gary, who played trumpet, and also a high school teacher, an alto saxophone player, James Blakey, that sort of Yeah.
My brother met him at Florida. I followed my brother to Florida A&M 10 years later.
Okay.
And that, you know, that was my move into music.
Mm-hmm.
I performed in the marching band at Florida A&M University. And I had the opportunity, Wanda, to march, check this out now, in Super Bowl III.
Seriously? Wow.
Super Bowl III when the Jets walloped the Colts. Also, at that same time, many people cannot have the honor of marching in the last two American Football League All-Star games. So those are big for me because they'll never be done again, especially the All-Star, the AFL All-Star game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the league is merged. It's the American Football Conference and the National Football Conference now. That was a big deal. That was a big deal for me.
Mm-hmm.
While I was at A&M.
Yeah, yeah. And then while you were in college, you had a band called Funk Incorporated.
Funk Incorporated, sweetheart, was the national and international collegiate pop collegiate group. In 1971 or 1972,
mm-hmm.
We competed against all of the major universities as a small black university, and winning in the nationals in Chicago, we were sent to Montreal, Canada,
mm-hmm.
where we took everything there. Budweiser sponsored that music festival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow.
So,
and then your relationship to bands continued. Were you drafted or did you join the Army?
A little of both. and if I say it in more one, I may have to do something real violent, so I'm going to leave it right there.
Yeah.
A little of both.
Uh-huh. So you told me that you led, you conducted all the bands? No, that was what you did for the... San Francisco Unified School District. Yeah.
High schools, yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right. But I was also Johnny Otis, the Johnny Otis Show, assistant band director.
Mm-hmm. Wow, yeah. Yeah, so what is it with you and these bands?
It's my mother played piano for almost 60 years every Sunday at a different church. So, and from there, my brother in college was asked to go out with Lionel Hampton when he first formed his big band.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's just, wow. it's just a thing. It just, that's what I do, baby. That's what I do.
Yeah, that's neat. So are you still teaching, or are you just doing your,
no,
you know?
I'm retired now.
Oh, good for you. So now you can just do your band thing, huh?
I'm just doing my music. I'm just doing music now.
Cool, super.
And I like a chance to do what I'm going to do.
Mhm. Yeah. You mentioned that Illusions was also inspired by a tragedy in your life.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The Larry Douglas Hall Dedications album was initially released in 1984. My oldest son fell off the bed when he was, weeks old and crushed his skull. Hmm. And eventually had brain damage and water on his head. So it was hydrocephalic.
Mm-hmm.
And the pain that this kid was in for 3 years, seizures, everything. the strength. If you can, not necessarily admire, I'm at the lack of words, but the strength in this young kid to endure the pain that he did,
mm-hmm.
and live for 3 years and keep a smile on his face. I mean, it was enlightening to me. It help me out, one. I'm trying to help me out. I'm trying to. It was uplifting,
mm-hmm.
and my tribute to him was this album.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to say I understand. Some of the soldiers some of the soldiers survive, and some of the soldiers will leave quite early. And he was one of the soldiers that left early.
Yeah. Mhm. Right.
And Illusions was a tune that, for me, it describes what his evolution would have been because of the changing in rhythm, the changing in times.
Mhm.
You know, so that would give me a time for him to be able to grow and become a man. And that's my idea of his life cycle. Illusions.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Well, if you want to, we could close our conversation with that, and we could pick it up again in the new year.
I sure would like to.
When you are going to be, releasing or re-releasing this album.
Yeah,
because it's on vinyl, and so we, those of us that don't have record players, can't play it.
Right, I'm going to re-release it on a CD in the next couple of weeks. The Larry Douglas Hall, can I plug myself real fast?
Totally, yeah, definitely.
The Larry Douglas Hall Tet,
mm-hmm.
featuring the CD release party of Dance of the Kalahari, will perform at Angelica's Historical Bell Theater in Redwood City.
Mm-hmm.
The address is 863 Main Street. And this is December 23rd.
Oh, nice.
We will be down there.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we will have a beautiful day and we will be able to really present our catalog in its entirety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What time is that?
Probably shows may start probably between 7:30. Right now, between 7:30 and 8. We haven't decided just yet how we want to.
Okay.
Which time we're going to go with, but I will have the information for you.
Okay, excellent. Oh, that's super. Do you have a website?
Yes. www.LarryDouglasAllTet.com.
Okay, makes it easy. So you're going to have that information there too, right?
Yes, it'll be there also.
And it's Douglas with one S.
Douglas with one S.
Yeah. Whenever I see Douglas, I always think about Frederick Douglass. All the Douglases that I ever think about, it's like, oh, they're all related to Frederick
Douglass. Yeah, I have that moment also.
Yeah. Okay, well, excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning. And we're not going to be able to play the whole piece, but we'll play it until our next guest joins us, Illusions.
Okay.
And what's your son's name, the one that you did this piece for, who is no longer with us in this form?
Isn't it Jaskin Xavier Douglas?
Say it again.
Jaskin.
Jaskin.
Xavier Douglas. Jaskin Duprez was one of the guys that I studied in music history. And he always came up and he was a thorn in my side. And to make sure that I remembered him, I named my first son Jaskin.
Mm-hmm.
And we call him Jock for short.
Okay.
Josquin. Jaskin.
Okay, cool. Well, this is to you, Jaskin. I know you're listening.
Untitled. That's right, Untitled, isn't it?
Hmm?
Should be Untitled.
Oh, is it Untitled? I thought it was Illusions. No?
We did Illusions early.
Oh, is it Untitled? Oh, so we played Illusions, so we're doing Untitled. Is this for Jaskin?
Yes, it's either Untitled or Molly. I'm sorry, I can't remember what we decided on.
Oh, I don't remember now. I mean, I have Untitled, and I have Illusions because those are yours. And so we opened with Untitled.
Illusions.
I thought we opened with Illusions. I don't remember. It's the one with all the horns that you played last week, but I don't remember.
Oh no, you said you opened up with Yesterday's Letters.
Oh yeah, yeah. I opened before you came on the air, and I'm talking about since you've been on. What?
That was Illusions.
Oh, that's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah.
You get me all mixed up. Okay. All right. So
I'll do that.
Okay. So Illusions was for Jaskin, right? Your son.
Yes.
Right. And so now we're going to play Untitled.
Untitled.
Right?
Thanks, Wanda.
Okay.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's good having you on.
All right.
Okay. Here we go.
All righty.
right, the time is right for love, but you're not there beside me. So I'm just feeling my way. Jump out of bed, I take control. If I can just control this fire that burns in my soul, Lord, help me make it through a brand new day. The stars of night shining bright, my heart was pining for you. Through space and time, someday your love I'll find. Someday we're gonna meet, then my life will be complete. Until that lucky day, I'll pass the time away with you in my imagination, 'cause you're always on my mind. Up in the morning, oh, my job is getting hard to live without. Something tell me your good love I've got to find. Ladies up and down the street, looking so fine, so sweet. I look for your face everywhere. Where can you be? Ooh, baby, come home to me. I know you're out there somewhere. So let's begin this love affair. So fine, so fine.
We have had some really wonderful music from Dance of the Kalahari. And Wanda, Larry, are you still with me?
Yes, I am.
Okay, well, my other guest didn't show up, so that's why you heard all this music. I'm like, oh, he's still in the studio. Stay in the studio while I get this thing together. So anyway, do you want to talk for a little bit longer?
Let's talk.
Huh?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, super. I was going to play, before we start, why don't I play the little bit, the reprise of Dance of the Kalahari, and let's talk about, you know, some of the music that's on this CD, and the men, you know, that you all are honoring in this memorial release.
Yeah, it would be great.
Okay, sure.
You know, the Dance of the Kalahari, Dance of the Kalahari reprise is probably about 48 seconds.
I know.
That was our idea of the caravan as it fades into the moonlight. Or the sunlight.
Yeah.
As the light dissipates, you can hear everybody going through the sounds of the journey.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what that's all about.
Okay, well, let's play that.
Good.
Okay.
Yes, Wanda.
Yeah. So let's talk about Umoja. And because you came and you were like in the second wave of Umoja.
Yes.
Yeah. So how do you know the band, and how did they know to grab you?
well, Baba Kamal Saitu,
mm-hmm.
One of the co-founders with Damo Sudi. We've played together since Carlton Hester danced a jazz art movement in the 70s.
Oh, wow.
And also, Baba Kamal was instrumental on my album, Dedications.
Mm-hmm.
So there's probably about three to four decade relationship there, at least a 3-decade relationship.
Oh, and like
30 years. When their trumpet player left the group,
mm-hmm.
he recommended me.
Okay, that's Mark, right? Mark Wright?
That was Mark Wright. That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
And once he recommended me, I fell into it, and the camaraderie, the spirit of these gentlemen,
mm-hmm.
I just actually embraced the idea of the collective. You know, for me, it was a godsend.
Mhm. Yeah. So tell us about, you know, sort of you know, you said that you like the idea of the collective, and definitely, you know, one thinks of bands as, at least it seems like you all are a family. I've never been in a band. I've been in a choir. Yeah,
well,
but it seems like, yeah, band, yeah. The only thing is, you know, sort of like, you know, in African culture and other indigenous cultures, you know, families sort of do these specific kinds they become artisans of specific types of crafts or like, you know, you have the jewelers and you've got, you know, the blacksmith, you've got the fisherman,
right.
And so you know, you come into the family and you are, you know, you play the brass instruments, you know.
Right.
Yeah. And then, you know, then you also have, you know, you have, you know, the flautist, which is also, that's not a reed instrument. That's also brass. And you had, you know, you had your...
It's reed. A flautist is reed. That's a reed instrument.
Okay.
It's considered a reed instrument.
It is, okay, yeah. And then you've got the percussion instruments, you know, the drums, plus you have a percussion instrument that's also a string instrument. You have the piano.
So
talk to us a little bit about this whole, the dynamics of an ensemble, you know, musical ensemble, and sort of how you come in with your instruments and, you know, sort of what attracted you. I mean, I know your brother, you were sort of following your brother's footsteps, but at some point, this started to be another alternative voice for you, you know, speaking through this instrument.
Excellent choice of words. It became another speaking voice, and that's what Umoja has allowed my playing to become.
Mm-hmm.
Another voice in intertwine with the other instrumentalists, their voices, and being able to weave our conversation to make some semblance of sense and direction so that we can present it to a grand stage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it's all about. Each one of Moshe's members bring just like you said, a specialty
mm-hmm.
to the loop. And it takes one or two people, but mainly one person to be able to hear the gestalt, to hear the whole,
mm-hmm.
and be able to fit the units into that whole so it becomes a real collective voice. And that was one of my, that has been one of my fortes.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to mold and shape a sound.
Uh-huh.
And that's what I did for 30 years.
Uh-huh.
With the bands that I taught in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And it really lends my strength here with gentlemen who can carry out those responses, those performance responses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it is. It's a performance response. You know, you write music, Wanda, and you hope that you can find that person who can take the music off of the page and make that music their own as a part of the collective sound. And that's what Umoja has done. Mm-hmm. It's taken a roadmap and have decided to recreate another map. And that's the creativity. That's that intuition. That's that middle eye. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To have that middle eye to see through, I mean, some of the artistic and creative and original processes.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's happening in Umoja.
Yeah.
That's what I like about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you're not going to believe this, but my guest, L. Peter Callender, is in the studio now, and
good.
Yeah,
good.
Really happy that you were there to sort of tie me over here when I was getting nervous.
I'm so sorry, Wanda. I could not find my telephone. I couldn't find my phone. It was. I apologize.
Okay.
I never do that to you. I'm so sorry.
Oh, that's okay, Peter. That's okay. Peter, meet Larry. Larry, meet Peter.
Hey, Larry. How are you, sir? Thanks for filling in. I appreciate it.
All right.
Well, Peter, we've got about 10 more minutes. Thank you so much, Larry. We're definitely going to have you on.
Man.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
All right, you take good care. So, yeah, so Peter, we don't have a lot of time, so.
I'm so sorry, Wanda. I'm so sorry. Okay.
No, it's okay. That's okay. You know, this is better than no minutes. Because you've got your Cinderella coming up, and you all have some special things planned for the Cinderella. It's like pre-performance arts and crafts and teaching and something. I was reading about it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Sherry is always trying to figure out ways we can get people involved in our theater. We can get more audiences involved, get people in the seats and all that. So we're going to have, like, arts and crafts, creating the little tiaras and talking about princesses, having little kids involved. Yeah, it's going to be fun. We're going to have young people working with the younger kids and creating their own tiaras and making little princess toys and crafts and things like that. So that'll help the Christmas spirit a little bit and have them enjoy the show a little bit.
Yeah, and I know last year you told me about how African American Shakespeare Company had matinees for school age kids that live in the neighborhood. You know, the school,
right.
Like, you know, I'm trying to think, Rosa Parks up the street, and there's a lot of schools in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
well,
and these were free of charge. I mean, you all were giving this to the community. I'm like, oh my God,
that's correct.
So nice.
Yeah. No, we just don't want, to give back. You know, we just don't want a lot of these schools who are going through their own little financial situations with loss of budget, with teachers, with class sizes, and funding to the schools is really, really low, and we just don't want the schools to pay to come see our show. So at African American Shakespeare, we offer all our matinees, our preview matinees to schools for free. Just call the theater and let us know that you'll be there, and we'll, as long as there are seats available, you'll be booked in. Just call the theater, we'll get you in.
Wow, well, let me give them that number. It is 1-800-838-3006, 1-800-838-3006, or you can visit African-AmericanShakes.org, and they're located in the Burial Clay Theater at the African American Art and Culture Complex, a real historic site. And it's at 762 Fulton Street at Webster in San Francisco, and all the buses stop nearby.
That's correct. And the nearest BART is the Civic Center BART. And this goes not just for Cinderella, but this goes for all our matinees. Our next, after Cinderella, we have Julius Caesar, and then following Julius Caesar is a wonderful adaptation of Sophocles' Antigone called Extigone, written by Nambi E. Kelly. She's out of Chicago. Brilliant young female writer, black. She's awesome. I predict a Tony Award in the next 5-6 years. She's an amazing. I look out for her. Nambi E. Kelly, mark my words. I'm putting it out there right now. She's awesome. Yeah.
And you just love your Greek plays. I mean, like, I think since you've been artistic director, I think you've had one in every show,
this is my second season. Yeah, this is my second season. I'm my second. I know. But there's something so wonderful about these Greek plays. The stories they tell is a worldly story. The real stories, of course, in a Greek theater. The Greeks started theater the way we know theater. So they, you know, we know these stories. They are rooted in truth, and they're rooted in family. They're rooted in culture. They're rooted in politics. Everything comes from these plays, and I love them. I probably won't do one next year, but look for one for the following season. But I love them. And this is a wonderful adaptation. It's got music, it's got rap, it's got poetry, it's got dance. Daryl V. Jones will direct it. It's really terrific, and I want everybody to come out and see it. Call the theater now and get the tickets for it. It's going to be the ticket to buy in the Bay Area.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I was reading about it. It says Extigone is the playwright Nambi E. Kelly's response to the untimely deaths of youth in her native Chicago as a result of gang violence, which has risen sharply in the past several years, and distressed by similar recent events in San Francisco, Oakland, other Bay Area communities, African-American Shakes, in partnership with Cal State University East Bay, is bringing this piece to stage. And, you know, that's just so wonderful the way African American Shakespeare Company always makes the classics relevant. If people say, like, black people and Shakespeare, black people and Greek tragedy, like,
I know.
What?
But why not, right? I mean,
totally.
Why not?
Yeah.
These, you know, we have so many young actors coming out of these conservatories, the ACTs, the PCPAs, the Solano Colleges, the Chabot College, Laney, all these terrific actors coming out of these universities and conservatories, and they're going straight to New York, straight to L.A., straight to Chicago, and they're not getting the opportunities to do the classics. And we're saying, yeah, we're here. We are. Bring it on. We want you here. We want you to stay in the Bay Area. We want you to push your talent forward. And who says these plays cannot be our stories as well? Cannot be stories told by well-spoken, well-dressed, well-articulated African-American, well, third-world actors in general. Mm-hmm. When I did my production of Twelfth Night, it was right. I brought in so many different types of actors for the show. I believe in diversity, and I believe that if you are talented, if you are articulate, if you have the drive, if you have the training, if you desire to have the training. And I say the desire because in my production of Twelfth Night, there was only one other actor, maybe two, who had actually performed in Shakespeare before. Most of the actors had not performed in Shakespeare, but the desire was there, and it was perhaps one of the most successful productions of the season in the Bay Area, totally. So we are there for these actors, and we're there to bring these new classics like Nambi's play to the forefront. And so far, it's been doing very, very well.
Oh yeah, well hey, you know, with you, how can they lose?
Thank you.
I mean, you're like,
all right, so much fun.
Phenomenal, and then you know,
it's
like...
so much fun. Thank you, Wanda. That's so nice. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And it's just so wonderful to see Sherry Young directing a play again. I just miss her.
Yes, in the
mix, and here she is directing Cinderella. So, what kind of surprise do you have for Cinderella this year?
We changed it up a little bit. We have a brand new scenic. It's going to be. I don't even know what to tell you. The set is brand new. We have a brand new set. We've added a few contemporary political themes to it. A little hint of contemporary political adages to it. And as you said, Sherry Young is directing, and Sherry is doing a wonderful job. Mm-hmm. The boys are back, if you know what I mean by that.
Yeah, sure do.
Well, for those of you listening, the stepsisters. We've tried different ways of bringing the stepsisters to life, and throughout our seasons, the stepsisters have been boys. In drag, and it's just been hilarious. And last year we went in a different direction, and this year the boys are back.
Okay.
So we are thrilled with that. Martin, oh my goodness, Martin Grizel is hilarious. It's a wonderful, wonderful cast. It's alive. It's funnier than ever. Mm-hmm. It's tighter than ever.
Mm-hmm.
Brand new scenic designs. Some added music. So, and tickets are selling fast again. It's usually sold out before we open. So please now call, get your tickets. It's selling out really, really fast this season.
Okay,
Sherry's doing an amazing job.
Super, yeah, and it opens on December 2nd, that's
mm-hmm.
Friday, and it goes through the 13th or something?
The 13th, yes.
The
18th.
Yeah.
The 18th.
And you have... How does it run? Saturday matinees and evening, or just Saturday matinees? How does it work?
It will run set in the evenings.
Okay.
We run in the evenings, and there are a couple of matinees, early matinees.
Okay.
But the Saturdays and Sundays.
Okay, great.
Go to the website, check it out. We can buy tickets online. Certainly call the brown paper bag tickets, the number that you gave earlier for tickets.
Let me give it again. 1-800-838-3006, 1-800-838-3006, and tickets are $20 for students and seniors and $30 general.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also visit African-American-Shakes, SHAKES.org.
I just misspoke. We do have Saturday matinees at 3 o'clock matinees.
Okay, yeah, and I came to one. I was just wondering.
Yes,
no,
you're absolutely right.
3 o'clock
on Saturdays and 8 o'clock on Saturdays, and then 3 and 8 on 3 o'clock on Sundays as well.
Oh, good. Super. And in closing, because my next guest is in the studio, wanted to ask you about Julius Caesar. I've seen that before. So is this a reprise? I mean, Michael Jean's Sullivan, great writer, actor, playwright, that people really know from the San Francisco Mime Troupe. I don't know if he directed it before, but I remember seeing Julius Caesar performed or produced by African American Shakespeare Company when they brought in Malcolm X. And I'm is this the one again?
No. We're doing Michael Gene Sullivan. I've always wanted to work with Michael as a director with my company. He's directed me at Solano College in a wonderful play called I Am a Man, which I will probably bring to my theater soon, an award-winning production. And I'm a big fan of Michael. And then, as you know, Delina Brown, his wife, directed Cinderella last year for
us. It was so great.
It was so funny. But,
they're like a team like you and your wife, Margot Hall.
They're a terrific team of writers and award-winning writers and award-winning teachers and actors and, you know, and I wanted Michael's adaptation of Julius Caesar. It's a little different. It's set in Africa. It's quite different. It's only six actors. It's quite an ensemble piece. It's a little different than what we've done in the recent past. And we're looking forward to this, this new adaptation for Michael Gene Sullivan. Yeah.
Yeah.
Doing really
sure.
well. And just a quick plug for me personally, Wanda. I'm currently in a production called The Soldier's Tale at the Aurora Theater.
I love that play. Who are you?
This is A Soldier's Tale. I think you may be thinking of A Soldier's Play.
Oh,
right.
A Soldier's Tale.
This is A Soldier's Tale. It's music by Stravinsky. Mm-hmm. It is an old story. It's a wonderful story about a soldier on his way home from on leave who meets the devil on his way. It's a wonderful tale about greed and redemption and passion and love and love lost and love found and terrific music by Stravinsky. The group, the chamber music group Earplay, is doing our music.
Oh, I love that. Nice.
Mm-hmm. And Muriel Maffrey, who was a former prima ballerina for the San Francisco Ballet, directed and is also dancing in it.
Wow.
She's also and the soldier is a puppet.
Oh.
And she's also manipulating the puppet, and she does such an amazing. She makes this puppet dance. She dances with this puppet. In this wonderful ballet piece that she created, and I'm the narrator and the voice of the puppet. So we go through December 18th at the Aurora Theater in Berkeley.
Oh,
so plant a seed and come on through. We are at the Aurora.
Yeah, totally want to come through. Oh, super!
Please do, and when you come, let me come say hello.
Oh, definitely. Thanks for telling me. I wish I would have known earlier. I guess did it open in November or something?
We just opened we opened last week.
Oh, good. So it's the beginning. Oh, super.
It's very beginning. So we close January. I'm sorry, December 18th.
Okay.
So come on through, and thank you for your patience this morning. I do apologize, and have a great afternoon. And thank you for all you do, Wanda. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you, Peter. You know, hey, anything you do is fabulous, and
I'm so
on your team.
Thank you. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right. You take good care.
I will. Okay.
Peace and blessings. Bye. Oh, good morning, Louise. How are you?
I'm doing very good. How are you doing this morning?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm so happy to have you join us, you know, the day that you could be kicking back and relaxing, you know, you're joining us on
the air.
That's
okay. I'm working all the time.
yeah. I mean, your book, it calls you back, An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, Revolution, and Healing. It seems like you were always working, even, you know, when you were inebriated, you were like, when you came back to your senses, you were working. You always, it's like, wow. That's one of the themes, like hard work.
Yeah, exactly.
And political education, and you know, and always trying to be self-reflective. That really came through quite a bit in the first 100 pages of your book that I've read. And this is such a mature, autobiography compared to your lovely Always Running. I mean, I love Always Running, but this book here is like, oh, is that what he was doing when he wrote that book? Oh, my God, how did he get the book out?
Yeah, I know. I think it's important for people to know the growth, the evolution, what happens to people, the political growth, but also their own personal growth. And people were always asking me, well, what's the sequel to Always Running? And I thought, well, finally, I'm going to put it together. And it worked out because my son got out of prison last 2 summers ago, and it just seemed to be the right time to make this happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and congratulations, because, when Romero went into prison, I was like, wow, that was so sad.
So many families, and mm-hmm. I think the key thing is that it's so many people that you can't just say it's something wrong with these kids or these families. There's something that's very much orchestrated about how our kids end up in these prisons. But I also think it's very important that we stand by them as much mm-hmm. as possible.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. So let me introduce you to our audience that might not be aware of who is joining us in the studio.
Okay.
His name is Man.
Okay.
I'm going to just read the beginning of your bio because that could take the whole time. You've done so much. Luis J. Rodriguez has emerged as one of the leading Chicana writers in the country with 14 published books in memoir, fiction, nonfiction, children's literature, and poetry. Luis's poetry has won a Poetry Center Book Award, a Penn Josephine Miles Literary Award, and a Patterson Poetry Book Prize, among others. His children's books, America Is Her Name and It Doesn't Have to Be This Way, A Barrio Story, have won a Patterson Young Adult Book Award, 2 Skipping Stones Honor Awards, and a Parents' Choice Book Award. A short story collection, The Republic of East L.A., and a novel, Music of the Mill. It's like, how can you get music out of that place? My goodness. It came out in 2001 and 2005, probably after you retired, huh?
Right.
Both from Rayo Books and HarperCollins. A poetry collection, My Nature is Hunger, New and Selected Poems, appeared in 2005 from Curbstone Press, Rattle Edition. Limited edition handmade art books and broadsides of Luis's poems have also been made by C and C Press of Pajaro, California, for sale to collectors, universities, libraries, and other institutions, including 7, 2 Women, Dos Mujeres, and Making Medicine. And we already spoke about your wonderful 1993 memoir of gang life, Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A. Wow, now selling more than 400,000 copies. This book garnered a Carl Sandburg Literary Award, a Chicago Sun-Times Book Award, and was designated a New York Times Notable Book. And it became a stage play by the Cornerstone Theater Company, showing at the Mark Taper Auditorium in L.A. Public Library from 2003 to 2005 to 6,000 high school students, and the Ivor Theater in Hollywood for a limited six-day run in 2005. Wow, that is really wonderful. I've actually, when your book first came out, I used it in several semesters consecutively, and I introduced it to my colleagues at the Contra Costa College in San Pablo.
The students really
loved it. And, and I'm thinking about, I haven't decided what books I'm going to use in the spring yet. I might use it, calls you back, because I really like the way the book is set up, because you give us so much background because you're older now, and you're able to fill in more things that you probably more intuitively you knew when you wrote Always Running. But I hadn't realized that you were as young as you were when you wrote Always Running. I mean, you were a kid. I mean, you weren't even 25 when you wrote that book. You were so young.
Yeah, the first version of it. And I guess that's what helped me realize that I wanted to be a writer, because I had this story that I needed to tell. I didn't know when it was going to happen, and it finally did years later. But the point is, I was already putting it together even when I was young.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was wondering if I was, amazed at, again, how much you crammed it to, 19, 20, 21 years of marriage, 2 kids, a former gang life, community organizing, factory work, apprenticeships, recovering addiction, unaddressed PTSD. It's like, wow. And I was wondering, and you also moved around a lot. I mean, a whole lot.
Yeah.
and wherever you moved, you set up, you and your wife, or even when you were by yourself, you set up these education, for the community. You had folks coming in, they borrowed books from you. I'm like, wow, that is so amazing. So how is your work as a writer and an organizer, your redemption song?
Well, it's big now. I mean, in the sense that my wife and I, my present wife,
mm-hmm.
We have a beautiful cultural space and bookstore. This is very hard to do, and it's very rare. We're in a community of about 500,000 people, 80%, Chicano, Mexican, Central American, and there was not one bookstore, a movie house, or art gallery until we opened our space. Nothing for 500,000 people, which is like the size of Oakland. And I this is how I've expanded what I do. So we have the space, we serve from four, you know, actually it's like 6,000 to 8,000 families a year. Little kids all the way to the elderly, and then we have a youth program called Young Warriors that addresses more of the troubled kids, you know, gang members and other kids. And we just expanded everything I've been doing all these years. Now that I'm sober, I can actually concentrate and work hard on it. And my wife runs everything, you know, 60-hour weeks. You can imagine how this is going, but it's worth every minute that we do this.
Yeah, I was as I was reading your book, I just was reflecting on, you know, Elijah Malik, you know, Malcolm X, and how, you know, when he was incarcerated and he learned how to read, and he was, you know, reading, you know, sort of devouring, you know, information about sort of the plan, the game plan, and how he had been being manipulated because he didn't know the game plan, you know. And whereas you, you know, I was just thinking of some of the language, overlap of the language. I was thinking about James Baldwin and The Fire Next Time, and I thought about, you know, the letter he wrote to his nephew, and then I thought about Richard Wright's, not only Black Boy, but American Hunger that predates, you know, Black Boy, just sort of looking at sort of the juxtaposition of being, you know, a person who could touch slavery. I mean, it was that close.
Yeah.
And then being in the city.
I think anybody who's been oppressed, anybody who has gone through the kind of history that African Americans have, words, books, language are liberating their power. It's so, when I was growing up, the only books I could relate to was like Malcolm X and, you know, James Baldwin and Claude Brown and all these writers, including, of course, Perry Thomas. They were the only ones that I could read that could connect to what I was going through, and I could see how they were being transformed just by getting language in their life. And so that became my path. I found it the most liberating thing I could do because I was a very violent kid. I was a drug-addicted kid. If I didn't have a way to go take it somewhere, I don't think I could have overcome it. So books became so important for me, and I think that books become vital for people who've been deprived of knowledge and awareness of history and voice. Books are like the key to breaking through.
But it's just so amazing, you know, when you write about the addiction and the brutality and the holes, drugs and alcohol field, you know, the violence against yourself, you know, the self-destruction. And then later on you reflect on, you know, the post-traumatic stress disorder that you hadn't realized that you were a victim of, you know, that's where all this rage was coming from, was from that. Yeah, but yet, you know, you went to the library and you read books. I mean, your friends knew that you read books. And then you ran for the school board. I'm like, wow, this is so cool. I mean, like, it's just like,
I was
you just
kind
do,
of a weird homeboy.
Like,
I was kind of a weird
stuff.
Homeboy. I was like not quite your regular homie, you know. I was
kind
of weird. But I think it helped me. It helped me that I had political sense, literary, you know, that there was community, even if it was very small, that I had purpose. I think this is what I work, when I work with kids, I try to get them to find those things because it's really hard. These kids are addicted to the violence. They're addicted to their own suffering. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They're addicted to their own chains, the chains that that society's put on them, but they have bought into. And now they're addicted to it. You know what I'm saying? It's hard to break away when you don't seem to imagine there's another way out of this. So I use my experience to help others because I think that's vital that people realize they have to have a different dream than the world that's been given to them.
So I was wondering, so tell us about, you know, who was your James Baldwin? You know, who was writing you letters, you know, philosophically? And because you mentioned some of these folks in the part of the book that I read. You know, who was the one that let you borrow his wife's library card to go check out books, you know, about white folks that were not against, you know, Black folks or people of color. You know, who were some of these people that sort of guided you through the madness or in, you know, even though you were in the madness, they didn't give up on you. Talk about some of these folks and how you came out of that. Because I was just in the part of the book where you talk about early on is, you know, how you just quit heroin and you quit everything and just how much clearer you were and how much more you could do, you know, not being all foggy like that. Not that it lasted a long, long time, but, you know, sort of talk about some of these folks that you mentioned that helped you and that believed in
you. Sure, I think that's really what it is that somebody saw me and believed in me when nobody else did. And they were mainly the activists in the Chicano movement, which was, as you know, going around at the same time that the Black Panthers were organizing and all those organizations. In East LA, we had the Brown Berets, and we had the Mecha groups, and a lot of the more radical wing was the ones that came around to my neighborhood and started working with gang kids, try to politicize this, give us knowledge, awareness. Not everybody in my neighborhood went along with it. In fact, I'm surprised, you know, I probably was the only one that really hanged in with it. But it opened up my whole life to a world I didn't know existed. And I guess I always had a social justice part of me, even when I was a little kid. You know, I always took on the underdog, you know. I always got mad when I saw injustice on TV or anything. Even in my family, when my mother was very abusive, I'm the one that stood up to her, which nobody else in my family would do. I just had this thing, you know, I didn't mind discipline. I just didn't want it to be unfair and abusive, and I don't know why. I have no idea why I could even do that. But I think when I met with these mentors and leaders, they opened up that part of me, and they introduced me to books and showed me the kind of books that would just bring me to a whole new world. To me, that was powerful because it's very hard, as you can imagine, to leave the drugs and the gang. Yeah, as destructive as it is, you're so identified with it, you know what I'm saying, that whatever hole and emptiness you have in your life, the drugs and the gang seems to fill it so well. It's very hard to let it go. So I had to really find something bigger and better, even if it was just an imagination of it, because it's hard to imagine, to really live it. You have to imagine it first, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was helpful that I had books, like I said, that I was reading at the time that were also similar stories of people who were living similar lives, and yet their whole world were opening up to change and social justice as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned, you mentioned a lot of great folks. One of them is Nelson Peary and his wife.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, they, you know, I don't know, is that why you went to Chicago? Because they went to Chicago?
what it was, I met them in Watts. They were leaders in the African-American community there. They were training young people like ourselves to be serious, serious activists, serious thinkers, serious revolutionaries, and I really gravitated to them. And I learned a lot from especially how Nelson would speak and how he would talk and how he would teach. And when he ended up in Chicago, years later, I ended up in Chicago. I wanted to be part of that. You know, I wanted to be connected to that. I found that if I stayed wherever I was at, I kept falling back. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
My need to hang on to something that was more stronger, more organized, you know, better focus was so important. It's like hanging on to some of these mentors and hanging on to them. And so you find your own traction, because it isn't like you hang on to them forever. Eventually you find your own way, you know what I mean? And I have found my own way. But the point is, I needed them to help me find my footing. And I will always remember their teaching and their leadership. Nelson and people like that will always have a very important part of my life because of that, because they took a chance working with a kid like me.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad they did, because you are certainly a great investment, because, you know, sort of helping you and literally saving you, not just once, but saving you a lot of times. Look how many lives you've touched. I mean, my goodness, you've touched so many lives, you know, with your life and your story. It's just, you know, I mean, they didn't know that, you know, that the benefit would be multiplied so many times. But I think most people don't.
Yeah, I mean, when they teach kids, they don't always know how that seed is going to grow. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's like, I'm sure teachers go through this, and they don't know how that kid that was quiet and wouldn't say nothing, or maybe falling asleep all the time. Later, years later, they come to you and say, "You changed my life," and they didn't even know that they did anything. You know, you don't know the impact you're going to have with people. So my attitude is always treat people with respect. Always teach something. Always show kids where they need to go. If they don't get it, they don't get it that first time. If they're not there for you, don't worry about it, because you don't know how that seed gets planted and how it ends up getting nurtured. And in my case, whatever all my teachers did eventually came together somehow. It didn't seem like it in the beginning. I'm sure some people got very disappointed by the way I did things, but eventually it all began to come together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I'm really happy that you come to Oakland a lot. I'm glad you're closer now. I know you were back in California, but I remember you. I told some of my students about your being at the Cesar Chavez Library for Dia de los Muertos. How did that go?
It was packed. It was a wonderful, amazing discussion. It was high level. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, I don't want to just talk and then have people walk away. I want them to come away with something that they can really think about and share and understand and take back with them. So it was amazing. We had the whole place back. So, you know, I am coming back because the Bay Area is so important for me. So I will be in the East Bay again. I'm going to be doing the December 1st. I'll be at the Eastside Cultural Center.
Right there. 6 to 8 o'clock. Mm-hmm.
6 to 8. And then in San Francisco, I'm going to be at City College of San Francisco on Monday, December 5th.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm going to San Quentin and I'm also going to Alameda County Juvenile Hall again. So
lovely.
I love coming to the Bay Area because of just the fans I have, but also the great discussions that I have with all the people whenever we get to anything there.
Yeah. Oh, that is fantastic. That is simply fantastic. I'm just thinking, you know, I just thought how appropriate, you know, for you to be giving a talk on Dia de los Muertos, you know, a day that we remember our ancestors and we celebrate our ancestors. And throughout, you know, your work, you know, you tap into, you know, the indigenous culture and heritage, you know, that, you know, you as a young student were instrumental in sort of uplifting in the school district, you know, like celebrating the diversity of the population and having, you know, Latino studies in the high schools, you know, which spilled over into, you know, the colleges, et cetera, et cetera.
It's very important, to honor your history, to honor that ancestors. I think everybody is looking to be spiritually engaged. They're all on a spiritual quest. And I found mine within my own culture, which I didn't know about because, you know, it's very hard even for Mexicans to be connected to the indigenous, even though we're all indigenous people, you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
But I did find people who I have to thank the Native American communities who embraced me when I was looking for this, particularly on Pine Ridge, the Lakota people, and the Navajo Reservation, and my teachers there, who embraced me and embraced my indigenous, but also my quest, because they helped me get back to those roots that I needed to get back to. And that's what helped me stay sober, too, by the way. I've tried a lot of programming, recovery, but I found the most valuable recovery program was among my own indigenous traditions. And so I'm thankful for that because it's helped me stay focused, centered, and still active. That's important.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. I was thinking when you talked about, you know, sort of the journey and the healing journey at that, I was thinking about an essay. I'm not sure if you edited this collection, but you're in it. It was about the whole term around macho. That was another thing I assigned to my students. Like, oh, this is so good. So they had all this running, and they had that collection, and they also had James Baldwin's Nose of a Native Son. I thought they were a great combination. Right. Kind of heavy, but, you know, hey, we're in college. And I just thought about the whole idea, the way you talked about macho, and just sort of revisioning that sometimes derogatory or often derogatory word because it conjured up all of these real stoic, unpleasant ideas and feelings around what it means to be a man, what it means to have a man like that in your household. Yeah, I was wondering if you could talk about sort of that and sort of coming back to your healing journey. And writing definitely is a part of that. And I just love how your first wife, Camila, you described how she would give you a sacred, she would see your writing as sacred, and she would give you a sacred space,
put your food outside
the door, not interrupt you. I thought, that is so sweet.
I have to honor her for that. We didn't get along. We battled. But there were certain things that she did that I think were very, very, very sweet. And, you know, me and her now, we're very close. And we're close because of our kids, and we know we have to be there for them. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's important to just respect that, because to me, the arts is sacred. It's your purpose in your life, and everybody has to find what's artistic within them. And if they do, then I think they're going to find their life. This is what they were meant to live. That, to me, is what's important about the whole thing. So that's part of the story. How do you get your healing? How do you get your community? How do you find what you're here to do? And then to be active and to help bring real social justice and change puts all those gifts that you have for some meaning, because that's what we're all looking for. So to me, that this whole journey, this whole trek has come to that point. But now I have to give back. It's not about me personally, you know what I mean? It's about what kind of world can we make that's better than the world we came into. And I decided that I would be forgiving and be close to my first wife because she's the mother of my kids, to as many of the other women I might have hurt. And being macho doesn't mean, as you know, a tough, you know, emotionless person, as everybody thinks it means. It means drawing on real male energy, which is complementary and necessary, connected to female energy. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And together, the female and the male properly aligned is powerful. And that, to me, is what's important about the real understanding of what macho should be.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah, and you're coming, you know, again to Oakland, and you know this area because, you know, what's going on here in Northern California is reflected in what's happening in Southern California, which is reflected in what happens, you know, in Chicago and New York and San Francisco, you know, a lot, you know, where the folks are.
Right. No, things are changing rapidly, and I think the people are getting organized. I think this is important. I think the violence that you're seeing in the Bay Area is extraordinary, and it shouldn't be happening. But I think the fact that people are still organizing and still pushing forward and doing it as nonviolently as possible is very heroic of them and very strong. I know there's things aren't perfect, as you know, any movement isn't perfect, you know. There could be more people of color involved. They can reach out to more of the migrant communities. But I think that things are moving towards real change. You know, I do need to qualify that. It turns out that December 5th, when I'll be at the City College, I want to make sure people know it's the Mission Campus, which is in Valencia.
Okay. Oh,
yeah,
nice.
7 p.m.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'll be there to speak. And so to me, these are the issues we'll talk about, by the way. All these things. What's happening in the Bay Area? What's happening with the Occupy movement? Where is it going? Where do we need to go? I don't want to say that I have answers. I want to say that I have hopefully the right questions and that we can all share into which direction we all need to be going towards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just love the way Eastside kept on popping up in your books. Like, Eastside, he's going to be at Eastside and Eastside, Eastside, L.A.
Yeah,
Eastside.
I know.
It's like,
Yeah, I know. The east side of the world, man. We're all coming from some east side.
Yeah, and I was just thinking, you know, when I was reading, I didn't realize that the first police officer, you know, that actually, I mean, he got life for killing someone. I thought that was so fascinating because when people were talking about Messerly, they were saying that he was the first policeman, but he wasn't.
Right, and I think that it's no big deal. It's just that we don't really know this history. It's kind of forgotten.
Yeah.
Nobody knows about this cop when it happened. His story was forgotten. I bring back into my book. It was a friend of mine. He was actually an enemy of mine who we became friends. You know, we were shooting at each other, and now we're friends. And he killed him. And that story was very big for a short time. Then it died, like all these stories. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really glad that in at least the Oscar Grant story, that's not dying. That people are remembering these terrible deaths that shouldn't have happened. But, yeah, it's very rare that police get off like this. And that's another case there with Oscar Grant and that police officer. So we need to be aware that there's history to this. By the way, I had to change the guy's name. His name is actually not that because I couldn't get, you know, you have lawyers and they want to know why, blah, 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 and all this stuff. Okay, I changed it. I changed my friend's name because I couldn't get permission from his family. You know what I mean?
Right.
But if people are interested, it's public record what actually happened, you know.
Okay. Yeah. And I love, you know, your details around COINTELPRO. Yeah, because, and you know, it's like, wow, I mean, this woman was an agent and she married this man.
Yeah,
like,
can you imagine?
Wow. No, it's like,
crazy
no, not
things
at all.
Going
like,
on
wow.
there.
Yeah.
And I don't think people get the full story. You know, I've read as much as I could about COINTELPRO and how they infiltrated all the urban organizations, the African American, Chicano, you know, in Native American, the white student movement. They infiltrated, they undermined, they did such damage. And the full story isn't told. And I'm barely talking about a small version of it because there's more to it that obviously somebody has to really research. I wish the real history would come out, how unfortunately our tax dollars were used to destroy some very viable and strong and good organizations. That concept is that they went after terrorist groups and groups that were destructive to the U.S., and that was just not true. They went after really good major organizations that were making change. And it left a big vacuum. You know, that there's a really good documentary on the origin of the Crips here in South Central that started because they said that when the Black Panthers were literally pushed out, destroyed, when all those organizations were gone, a big, huge vacuum was laid in the community there, and the Crips was one of the ways that vacuum got filled. So in many ways, I'm convinced that what they did in those days contributed to the level of street violence and crime and drug violence that we see today. I know people find that hard to believe, but it isn't hard to make those connections.
You make those connections very well. And I was thinking, you know, the film Bastards of the Party, I like that better than the one Made in America, because in Made in America, they leave out the story of Stanley Tookie Williams. And in his book, autobiography, he talks about this family, this man that he looked to as a mentor was an agent. I'm like, oh my goodness,
this
is crazy.
It was really sad. People you trusted. Amazing. And then, of course, when drugs came in, more people would be informants because some of them were so drug addicted that they'll do anything to get drugs. And I knew guys that were being given drugs by the government and then used as informants. Can you imagine?
Yeah,
and
then
drug addicts kept his drug addicts, you know.
And then the person you mentioned who was killed, you know, he was found with an overdose of heroin. I mean, it was just like, you know, the level of toxicity was like crazy. It's like, oh, somebody gave him an overdose.
Yeah, because most people that overdose because of the cuts, you know, people put in all kinds of materials in there.
Mm-hmm.
But when you see a guy overdose and they find out there's a super amount of heroin, that they don't do that to themselves. You know what I mean? Somebody but that's their way of trying to pretend that he killed himself because he was a heroin addict. He was actually a guy that left heroin. You know, he wouldn't have done that. You know what I'm saying? It's these question marks that we have about what happened to some of the people we knew.
I wanted to ask you, have you ever gotten your FBI file before the USA Patriot Act 1 and 2? I don't know if you can get it now.
No, but one of these days, somebody says I should. I have a good friend in the Native American community that when he did this, he found it was like, he said it was 17,000 paper. They sent him 17,000, pages.
Wow.
I go, oh, my God. You know,
that's
that guy. Can you imagine? I don't know. Someday I guess we should. It's very costly, actually.
It's not free?
Costly.
Oh,
no,
they gave it to you because it's your record.
No, they do make you. Yeah, they say you have a right to it, but they make you pay for all the copying. And here's the other goofy thing, because I've seen them. They mark out so much. My friend's pages, something was all total black. It was all marked out. It's like they're still not really disclosing. You'll have 17,000 pages and a good number of them, some of them will be blacked out completely. It's really crazy. So one of the reasons I haven't pursued this is because I don't think it's going to be a true account about what they were investigating. But I hope someday, especially if the government allows it, we can get the truth about what actually happened during those 60s and the 70s.
Yeah, that would be really great. Yeah, because you had a lot of angels looking after you. I mean, you know, you are truly blessed because,
have,
you know, people in all, because, you know, one of somebody in law enforcement told you to watch your back.
I know. Even with the police, there was people that actually liked me. Can you imagine? You never know how things are going to play out. I always treat people, even police officers, with respect. When they're abusive, I don't let them off the hook. But I just never know who's going to help. It's amazing how sometimes people even, you know, I have a friend who served 15 years in the LAPD, and he told me that he was brought into the Metro Groups as an informant and an agent and an operative, and he was brought into, he said, really good Chicano organizations. He knew they weren't doing anything bad, but they brought him in. And the reason he quit the department is because the police officers killed his brother, who didn't know he was his brother. He was an addict in the street, and they killed him, and he heard them laughing about it. And they didn't know that was his brother. You know what I'm saying?
Wow.
And he said, no, I'm gone. I'm tired of this. So I have police officers who can verify a lot of what we're saying because they're very few and hard to find. You know what I'm saying? Most police officers know this stuff. They just keep it to themselves. They don't want to speak out. Mm-hmm. But every once in a while, you know people who know. So So it's important to have that because, like I said, this knowledge has to come out eventually somewhere, some way. Mm-hmm. We have to know exactly what happened.
Right, yeah, and we have a really wonderful organization here. I'm sure you're aware of it, Freedom Archives. And
yes.
Claude Marks is the executive director, and they have a new film. It's called COINTELPRO 101 that I know you would just love. And do you know that? Do you know that particular?
No, I don't, but I definitely would love to do that. It's great.
I'll send the information to Juliana to get it to you. Because they're right here in San Francisco, so you could definitely get a copy of it while you're up here.
Great. Thanks.
Yeah, because it's very well done, and they're the same organization that did the wonderful documentary on the San Francisco 8 and looking at torture of people.
Yeah. Wow, that's very important. Good for them.
Yeah. Well, gosh, it's been really wonderful connecting with you, and I was wondering in Chicago, because I know you're connected to a lot of organizations as well as the founder of quite a few. Are you familiar with Cease Fire, and were you involved with? Okay.
Actually, what happens in the Increase the Peace Network that we created?
Yes.
That became I don't know if people won't know this, but that became kind of a model for the way the ceasefire eventually organized. Don't ever give us credit for it, I understand. And it also went off in different directions than we were going. But we really took that idea that you can get communities to agree to help with jobs, training, education, and all that. And then the kids would also make agreements to stop the drug dealing and violence. And we actually had that going. Again, ceasefire has become something else. But I do know people that work for them. I support anybody who's trying to bring peace in our streets. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of history with some of that before it even became as big as it became. And my son, by the way, who's in Chicago, he's out of prison. He's been working with gang intervention. He just left a job where he was turning around 100 gang kids. And I met those gang kids, and I have a lot of respect for him, and he did a really great job. He's also getting active in the same kind of work.
And you have, what, 4 children, I believe?
I have 4 children and 4 grandkids, and all my grandkids are teenagers. I have to tell people that because it's kind of even amazing to me that my grandkids are all teenagers. But, yeah, I have 4 kids who are, even though my oldest kids were very troubled, as you know, they went through a lot of problems, especially Ramiro. They're all doing very well. I'm very proud of all my kids. And it took a long time to be that father they needed. It took a long time for them to see what they needed to be responsible for. But in the long run, you know, both my oldest son and daughter are doing really great. I had a great Thanksgiving with my daughter Andrea yesterday. She's an amazing person, but she went through hell and back. And I feel very bad about that and very responsible. But I think we've coming together, to me, is what's important, that family can find the point of unity and their love and embrace each other. So to me, that's what's important now.
So this personal journey is also a family's journey, and as you heal, then you're able to help your family heal from any of the wounds.
That's right. I think my son took an example that I gave him, and I didn't know he was going to do this, and he gave up gangs and drugs while in prison, which is very difficult and very dangerous. But he felt he needed to. I think he began to see that I was going to be serious about being sober, that I was going to be serious about being a better father. I think he really began to see that. And then he decided to make his change, which I'm really grateful for, but it was very dangerous there for a long time. I didn't know whether he was going to survive it, and he did. But as you can imagine, it's a very difficult decision to make while you're in prison.
And on the postcard, is that a picture of your children?
So there's a picture of me and my oldest son when he was 1 year old with my first wife.
Okay.
And then it's me and him when he's older, when he's, I guess, 17 or 18, I forget. But anyway, so that's a little bit of a little history there.
Right, yeah. This is so cool. Yeah, so I'll let our audience know again, we're speaking to Luis Rodriguez, and he is going to be in the Bay Area for quite a while. He's going to be hanging out for about a week, and he's going to be visiting us at Eastside Alliance, Eastside Cultural Center on Thursday, December 1st at 6 p.m., and Eastside Cultural Center is located at 2277 International Boulevard in Oakland, and it's a free event. And then on Monday, December 5th, Louise will be at City College of San Francisco Mission Campus, room 162, 1125 Valencia Street in San Francisco. And the phone number there is 415-239-3126. Is that a free event as well?
Yes, that's free.
Oh, super, super. Okay.
Yeah, I want to meet all the people that we need to talk to, so try to do as free as we can.
Oh, nice, nice. And do you have a website that people can visit to stay in touch with you?
Yes, I do. So they should go to LuisJRodriguez.com, no hyphens or no underlining, LuisJRodriguez.com. You'll also, when you get there, you'll see where my new book is. You can order it right through there. You can also find out about Dia Chucha's Centro Cultural and Bookstore, the cultural space that I have here in L.A., so they can find out about what we're doing there. So I think that's a great website to kind of just get into most of my blog, all the things I have to say about what's going on, like with Occupy Movement or anything that's happening.
Yeah, yeah. So in L.A., I think L.A. has the only Occupy Movement left, right? I mean, that people are actually able to, like...
Yeah, they're negotiating to move. Who knows what's going to happen. They're trying to avoid, which I think is a good idea, the police beating down on them.
Mm-hmm.
But who knows what the outcome's going to come, because there's issues, you know what I'm saying, about whether it should be moved or shouldn't be moved. And so we'll see what happens, and I hope it doesn't get to be a violent thing.
Yeah, I hope not. I was wondering, in closing, can you, like, share something from your book or share some of your poetry with us?
Well, probably a poem would be good.
Okay.
I love the poetry. A lot of people don't realize how much of a poet I am. So let me read one of my earliest poems, okay?
Okay.
It's called Piece by Piece, which I wrote as an answer to being treated and being labeled as troublemaker all my life.
Mm.
So it goes like this. Piece by piece, they tear at you, peeling away layers of being, lying about who you are, speaking for your dreams. In the squalor of their eyes, you are an outlaw, dressing you in a jacket of lies, tailor-made in steel. You fit their perfect picture. Kick it off. Make your own mantle. Question the interrogators. Eyeball the death in their gaze. Say you won't succumb. Say you won't believe them when they rename you. Say you won't accept their codes, their colors, their putrid morals. Here you have a way. Here you can sing victory. Here you are not a conquered race. Perpetual victim, the sullen face in a thunderstorm. Hands, minds, they are carving out a sanctuary. Use these weapons against them. Use your given gifts. They are not stone.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, the one thing that comes really clear in your writing is how, you know, you define who you are.
Yeah.
You know, even in the madness, you know, you are not succumbing to other definitions of who you are.
Very important. Thank
yeah.
you for that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you again. Enjoy your weekend and have a safe journey
I
up to state.
It.
We're looking forward to having you in our area again, and I look forward to meeting you.
Thank you so much, Wanda. Take care.
You take good care. Peace and blessings.
Bye.
So we are going to close out with blessings from the first CD, Umoja CD, by the same title. This is the title track, Blessings, by Damu Sudi Ali.
Let's
that was Blessings Again from Umoja. That was their first CD, and that was the composer is Damusudi Ali, and the special guest artist singing is Jamila Uwezu. And on another track we played a little earlier, Feeling My Way, from the second CD, Umoja, Dance of the Kalahari in Memoriam, that we were speaking to Larry Douglas about. That guest artist singer was Willie G, famous Willie G, and he was so fantastic at 57th Street Gallery at the CD release party on Sunday, November 20th. Really, really fun. It was just fantastic. And since I have you on, I think I want to play another one of the pieces that I really liked, and it's called... let me find it. Our Problem to Solve. And I'm trying to think. I think that's another Sudi composition, if I'm not mistaken. Or actually, you know what? It might be M.B. Hanif. You have to check last week's interview, last Friday interview, to be sure. I want to thank so much our guests this morning, Larry Douglas, Jivanka Jean-Baptiste, the wonderful writer and organizer and peacemaker, Luis Rodriguez, and you don't want to miss him. He's going to be in town for quite a while, beginning December 1st, and he's going to be making a couple of appearances at Eastside Culture Center on the 1st, which is World AIDS Day, and then on the 5th at City College of San Francisco, their Mission Street campus, which is on Valencia, and both of those events are free of charge. So we're going to close with Umoja from Dance of the Kalahari, Our Problem to Solve.
A problem, a problem, a problem to solve. A problem, a problem, a problem to solve. A problem, a problem, a problem to solve.